Car crashes are the number one cause of death for 14 to 19-year-olds in Iowa, and lawmakers hope to change that statistic. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. A new law would put further restrictions under the state's graduated license system. We'll talk about what the new rules mean and hear about the research behind proposals which examined fatal car crashes involving teens in the state. But first, we'll talk about two new laws making their way through the legislature that would impact the number of inspections at the state's livestock facilities. Be a part of the conversation after this news. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. Two bills making their way through the legislature would impact the number of times livestock facilities, known as CAFOs, are inspected. CAFOs are concentrated animal feeding operations. The EPA says Iowa should be doing more to protect water quality, and environmental groups say lawmakers aren't adding enough inspectors to do the work. Joining me here in the State House Law Library is Senator Ken Rosenboom, a Republican from Oskaloosa and farmer. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Susan Heathcote, Water Program Director for the Iowa Environmental Council. Susan, welcome to River to River.
Thank you.
So are you concerned about the state's water quality? Are you a rancher or operate a CAFO? What are your thoughts? Give us a call, 1-866-780-9100, or reach out to us on Facebook at Iowa Public Radio. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. So, Senator Rosenboom, we'll start with you. Why does Iowa need more inspectors for livestock facilities?
Well, it's my understanding that the staffing has gone down somewhat over the last few years. And we need a certain level of inspectors, I think, to do simply what the department's required to do.
And since 2008, the number of inspectors has been diminishing.
That's my understanding, yes.
And the governor right now has budgeted about five more, is that correct?
That's correct. He has budgeted five more.
And so what is it like when an inspector comes into one of these CAFOs? Kind of walk us through the process. You've lived in farming and ranching country. Tell us a little bit about how that process works.
Well, typically they will come onto the site. And first of all, I think the first order of business is generally look at the paperwork to make sure the history, manure application records are all updated, fees have been paid, all that type of thing, the paperwork part of it. Beyond that, they will do a physical inspection. In my experience, they will observe the general condition of the facility, look for telltale signs of neglect or problems that could lead to leakage, for instance. They will check for things such as standpipes that might, during pumping operations, might be an avenue for manure to go into the groundwater system. So just make sure things are in good order, that the pit itself, the livestock manure pit, appears to be in good order, no obvious leaks and that type of thing.
And have you worked with these inspectors in the past?
I have, because a few years ago, for a period of time, I actually took care of about 30 manure management plans for local producers in Mahaska County. And in that capacity, I knew all the field office five inspectors on a first-name basis and worked with them closely for several years.
Pretty time-consuming. I mean, how long are they there? What is the process like for the livestock operator?
Well, any particular visit would not last that long. You know, to make a rough stab here, maybe an hour or maybe 2 hours. I did quite a number of them, so I spent a lot of time doing that. But then on an individual basis, unless there were problems, 1 to 2 hours would normally take care. I don't know what time they spend in the office prior to. Obviously, they came prepared with some history of being timely with fees and with the application process. But usually not terribly time-consuming. If there were problems, and I, in my experience, never really dealt with any problems, so it was pretty mundane and straightforward.
Susan Heathcote with the Iowa Environmental Council, do you feel that five inspectors is enough? There are some calls from the EPA that restrictions need to be tighter. Do you feel that that's an adequate number?
Well, I think first we need to look at where we were. Back in 2009, we had 25 inspectors statewide, and we currently have about 15 livestock inspectors.
Right, I should have said FTEs. Five more.
The issue of five additional doesn't even really bring us back to where we were in 2009. And at that time, I think, you know, we have to recognize also that I was a leading livestock producing state in the country, especially our hog confinements are, you know, top. I mean, we've got the top numbers of any state in the country and probably internationally as well, as far as the number of facilities we have. So this is a very important environmental concern in the state of Iowa. If the facilities are being managed and operated correctly and they're designed appropriately and they have their manure management plan, not just their paperwork in order, but their actual operational plans in order, then these facilities can be managed, especially with the need for the nutrients on our cropland. We can recycle those nutrients as a fertilizer, and that's the way the system should work in the state. Of course, the problem is a small number of facilities aren't being operated and managed properly, and there are problems out there. And what the EPA is asking is for state to actually conduct inspections of all of the both the large and the medium-sized confinements in the state of Iowa. And they estimate the number of those are about 8,000. And over the next 5 years, they want the DNR to do an inspection of all of these facilities to determine whether or not they're operating in a way to prevent discharges to waters of the United States.
So this concern is that as there is more manure that is being disposed of, that is contaminating the water quality, and the EPA is saying essentially, do something or we're going to come in and regulate it?
Well, I guess I would phrase it differently. I mean, if we are applying the manure, we're not disposing of it. We're applying the manure onto the cropland and doing it at the right rate in the right time of the year, then we're really, it's a benefit. It's actually not an environmental problem. Where it is a problem is if the facilities are not in good repair, if their storage is leaking, if their procedures for transporting or applying their manure are not appropriate, that's when we see the environmental risk. And I guess, it's not just the large facilities, it's all size facilities that have these issues. And that's one of the reasons that the EPA is asking for the state to actually inspect all of the facilities all the way down to about 750 hogs. It would be 300 animal units, which would equate to 750 hogs. And the reason for the inspections going down to the smaller ones is often we do find problems in those smaller facilities. In addition to, obviously, the risk is greater with the larger facilities because if something goes wrong, there's more manure there. But you know, in reality, it's really the management and operation that is the biggest risk.
River to River listeners, should there be more inspections of Iowa's livestock facilities? Are you a producer? How do inspections impact your bottom line? Are you a landowner who has been impacted by a manure spill? Tell us your story. Give us a call, 1-866-780-9100. Reach out to us on Facebook. We're at Iowa Public Radio, or tweet us at IPR Talk. And Senator Rosenboom, what happens if Iowa doesn't comply?
Well, doesn't comply. I'm not sure the nature of the EPA comments or opinions. What I do know is that Director Gipp has indicated in our Appropriations Subcommittee hearing that five additional inspectors would be adequate for him. And I'm sure that's what the governor based his recommendation on. So I guess I believe that we've talked a little bit about the history and so forth. First of all, there's been a lot less growth in the industry the last few years because of economics. So even though the number of inspectors has dropped, the amount of new facilities has been very limited the last few years. The department, as was told to us by Director Gipp, has learned to manage their people better electronically, digitally. There's a lot of improvements in terms of making their work more efficient. So I simply took Director Gipp at his word, and I really believe that five additional inspectors, if he says he can get the job done, I believe he can get the job done.
Susan, what are your thoughts there on what the senator has risen?
Well, our concern really is that if we have to shift resources to doing these routine inspections, that's going to take away from other resources for other purposes, responding to citizen complaints. If we had a lot of manure spills, that takes a lot of additional time for the staff. And then there are other regulatory functions that the field office has to, it's not just livestock. They regulate a lot of different industries, and we're very concerned because this is a five-year commitment. This is an increased inspection load that's going to take more resources, that those resources need to come from somewhere, and we think at least an additional 13 inspectors would give the DNR the resources they need to do the inspections and also maintain all of their regulatory responsibilities in the field offices.
So, Senator Rosenboom, should the DNR inspectors be working towards compliance or penalizing them for non-compliance? I mean, how does this process work?
Well, they should be seeking compliance. I mean, that's as opposed to enforcement, I think. And I think they've done a good job. Let me go back. Actually quite a few years to when we began to regulate livestock facilities. I've been involved with livestock production for my whole life, and I'll go back 40 years to when I was a young man in Mahaska County, and very typical of many other counties in Iowa, had roughly the same number of livestock and of hogs that we have today. And back then, there were very few confinement buildings. The waste largely was outside, and Mother Nature took care of distribution of the manure. It simply followed the path of least resistance to whatever waterway. Now we have a very excellent control of the waste, livestock waste. It's contained in DNR-inspected concrete pits that are occasionally inspected, and we inject all the waste directly into the soil. So I would argue that our manure management, and while farmers did push back against some of those regulations, and I understand why they did, the truth is we developed in Iowa, I think, quite a responsible, usable system that was a good compromise between all the parties involved. But the bottom line was we do a far better job of managing those resources now than we certainly did 40 years ago, and in much more environmentally correct ways.
Just a little bit ago, you said that they should be, operators should be seeking compliance.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, that means an acceptance on the producer's part that Iowans in general, and neighbors in particular, have an interest in how a livestock facility is operated. We all have an interest in clean water. We all have an interest in being good neighbors. And I think the regulations that have been developed in the state of Iowa have achieved that purpose. And for the most part, there's a lot of good players in the business. I can point to any industry, any of us can, to find out there's bad actors in any industry. But I think it's interesting to note, over the last few years, and I don't have statistics in front of me, but there's been quite a limited number of mishaps related to manure, to spills and that type of thing. They generally get a lot of press when they do happen. So I don't think we're ignorant of those things. I think that as a rule, this manure waste is handled in a very responsible, environmentally friendly way.
Susan, should the DNR be seeking compliance or penalizing more bad actors?
Well, we see that's a dual role for the DNR. I think first, obviously, is to work with the producers to get them into compliance. And I think that's, again, another really important part of these routine inspections. It's a real good time for the DNR to be working with producers to identify maybe some problems that they might have with their structures of their facilities or with their management. and try to, you know, get it out ahead of things and prevent those spills before they happen. And making sure DNR has resources to do that, that does take time. But, you know, obviously their first priority is to respond to complaints. But if they don't have staff to do both of those things, and when you respond to complaints, you're generally speaking, if you have a manure spill or a fish kill or something serious like that, you're going to have some penalties associated with that.
This late in the legislative process this year, is there, you know, you're wanting more than an additional five inspectors. Is it too late to be pushing for this?
Well, the Senate budget bill included the additional funding of $800,000 that would add to the five inspectors, it would add another eight. So about $100,000, I guess, equates to an FTE in the inspection. So if the Senate version of the budget bill or some compromise between the House and the Senate, then we would be looking at least an increase over, at least I would hope we'd at least get back to the 25 we had in 2009, which would require 10.
And now there's also a bill that reclassifies CAFOs. Senator, can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, House File 512 essentially made provision for a producer to, the term is mothball, mm-hmm. take out of service a facility for a period of time, for a designated period of time. And as I understand, the reason for that legislation was to, in a practical way, provide for a farmer, for instance, whose son goes off to college. He isn't able to take care of everything because of whatever reason, advanced age or health issues. And it would be a provision for them to mothball that building for a period, for a designated period of time. Until such time that maybe a son or daughter returns from college or whatever. That's just an example I'm using. But during that election period, as it's called in the legislation, that the farmer would be exempt from annual compliance fees, just as ongoing costs to annual costs to stay compliant. So I guess I think it's a common sense sort of thing, just as when we put a car into storage, you don't continue to buy license, pay fees for licensing, that type of thing. So I think it's good common sense governed.
Susan, do you see it as common sense?
Well, we have some concerns, obviously. Again, talking about the regulatory burden that the DNR has, currently they're regulated based on their capacity. And if they have the capacity for over 1,250 hogs in a confinement, then they would be required to pay the appliance fee, and also to have a manure management plan, which needs to be updated annually. The concern we have with changing it to be able to reclassify these sites is if they're coming in and out of the regulatory window, then DNR will have to be, you know, verifying the status of facilities that perhaps have been reclassified for a number of years, and this is going to require, again, an on-site inspection, because you can't tell, you know, what how many animals are in the facilities by driving by on the road. You would have to go and actually visit the facilities. I think the other big concern that we have is the bill as it in the House has it just related to whether the buildings are housing animals. And we're very concerned about using those buildings to store manure. And there was an amendment in the Senate version that included that the buildings would have to not only be empty of animals, but they would also have to be empty of manure. And that if they, for some emergency reason, there was need for storage, that they would have to have permission from the DNR on a temporary basis to store manure in those buildings. Again, coming back to what's the risk? It's not really the animals that is creating the environmental risk. It's the manure, the presence of manure in those buildings.
So Senator Rosenboom, which version do you support, from the House or the Senate?
Well, I'm fine with the amendment that the Senate offered. I think it just provides some clarification. So I have no problem with that. I just think it's good legislation all the way around. Susan mentioned just, you know, the need for more inspectors, but there's a component here we haven't talked about. In the late 2000s, there was quite a building boom. A lot of new buildings went up. DNR staff was required to do concrete specification inspections during the construction process, which added a great workload to them. That situation does not exist today. So it's simply their workload is less on a per site basis than it once was, just because of the new construction that is not happening now.
So we're not adding new facilities anymore?
We're not adding near to the degree that we were, say, 5 or 10 years ago. There was quite a building boom then.
So it seems like all this kind of boils down to is, how are we best balancing protecting the environment and more specifically Iowa's water quality, which has been judged to be pretty poor, and the need for producers to do business and be profitable? I mean, how do you balance that?
Well, let me back up a minute. You jumped from point A to point B with a lot of territory in between.
Okay. Let's cover that territory.
Just because the building's there the livestock facilities there does not necessarily mean that's causing our water quality issues. In my mind, the greatest water quality issue, and we're talking about this in the legislature today too, is the actual movement of soil. That's the source of our nitrogen and phosphorus impairment that we're trying to corral in Iowa. And I think it's quite a leap to make a point that because of facilities, livestock facilities, and if we solve problems there, that'll improve water quality. I think that's quite a leap, and I don't agree with that.
Susan, how do you take that?
Well, I think we are looking at some livestock producers that do have compliance problems. I do have some statistics here. We took a look at livestock's manure spills from 2001 to 2011. And again, you know, that was at the time the data that was available. And there were 262 manure spills during that time period that reached a waterway and resulted in 1.2 million fish being killed due to the toxic exposure to the ammonia. There were obviously other issues in addition to the dead fish. Nitrogen phosphorus is certainly very high in when you have a manure spill. So this is, you know, really a serious issue, and it's really more specific to locations where you have a facility that has a compliance problem. I mean, we do have situations sometimes where we have a cluster of facilities that have problems, and it's not just confinements. A lot of them are open lots, but the kind of facilities that we don't have as many of these days, but we still have some.
But is soil erosion a big environmental problem affecting our water quality?
Well, certainly. I don't disagree with that. But I think, you know, we have to look at all of our environmental problems. And certainly soil erosion is probably the most difficult, because that's not really a compliance issue. It is a chronic problem that is pretty much... And it's not just a farm issue, it's an urban issue. It's something that we have to deal with, much more difficult to deal with. But with compliance, I think we can get at that if we have the adequate staff at the DNR.
Okay. Thanks to my guests, Republican Senator Ken Rosenboom from Oskaloosa and Susan Heathcote with the Iowa Environmental Council. Thanks to both of you for being on River to River today.
Thank you for having me.
In the second half of the show, we'll talk about a law that creates new restrictions for teen drivers. I'm Clay Masters. That's coming up on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. Under law signed by Governor Terry Branstad, Iowa teenagers who want their intermediate driver's license will have to wait a little longer. The law makes it so teenagers can get their intermediate license at 16 and a full one at 17. This law would make it so minors with an intermediate license are only allowed to drive with one unrelated minor within the first 6 months of having the license. Before the law, they were allowed to drive with as many passengers as there are seatbelts. U.S. News and World Reports ranked Iowa 49th in the nation for its teen driving policy. Lawmakers hope to change that with this law. In the second part of River to River today, we'll talk with Republican Representative Josh Burns of Osage. He joins me here in the State House Law Library. Representative, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks, Clay. It's kind of turned into a regular visit here.
That's right. We'll also talk with Dr. Dan McGehee, the director of the Human Factors and Vehicle Safety Research Division at the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. That's a mouthful. Doctor, thanks for being here and welcome.
Nice to be with you, Clay.
River to River listeners, have the laws on teen drivers impacted you personally? What do you think of these tighter restrictions? Is it enough? Is it too little? Give us a call, 1-866-780-9100. We are also on Facebook under Iowa Public Radio, or tweet us at IPR Talk. And first of all, Representative Burns, explain the process that teenagers have to go through to get licenses.
Well, you know, it's funny because I'm living it right now. I have a 15-year-old daughter, and so we've gone through this as parents. But, you know, you start out with that driver's permit, and you put in your time there through the driving process. And then, you know, like for my daughter, and we live out in the country on an acreage, so she wanted to get her school permit. So then we had to take a look at getting her into a driver's ed program, getting her enrolled on that, and so we did. And then she had to go superintendent and get that that school permit piece taken care of. So, you know, it just kind of depends on what the family's looking at. If you're just looking at you're a city kid and you know, you're going to get your driver's permit, you're going to go through the driver's ed program. And then at age 16, you can get that intermediate license and then go from there to get your full rights after that, after you've put in that year time. So with this bill, we change it so that you, instead of 6 months, you have to have 12 months or basically before you can get your intermediate driver's license. You know, I think I like going from the 6 to 12 because, for one, it's more windshield time. I think that's valuable for the young driver. The other thing is, given what happened last week, we have a lot of changes in our weather patterns. And so I think it's good for these drivers to get 12 months under their belt so that they can see all the different things that are thrown at them from a weather perspective of living in Iowa. And then that whole passenger piece, I think that's also a good thing because, you know, I'll be honest, we very rarely allow our son to ride with our daughter to school. He's 11. And I could see him as a distraction to his 15-year-old
sister.
Imagine
that.
Yeah. So I think the more, and you know, and he's related. And so you start to get the unrelated passengers in that vehicle. You know, it really truly could be a distraction. So, you know, this bill in some people's eyes probably doesn't go far enough. But I think it's a good first step.
And how young can someone get a license in Iowa?
I mean, basically, you're getting your driver's permit at 14, so
okay.
If you classify that as a license, but, you know, your intermediate driver's license at 16. But with this bill, if you got your driver's permit for the first time at 15 and a half, you're not going to be able to get your intermediate license until you're 16 and a half. So you got to put in that full 12 months. And believe me, I know that some argued and they said, you know, well, how is that right that, you know, at 16 and a half, this kid, you know what? These kids know the dates. They know when they can start to get things. They remind parents. I don't think parents are going to lose sight of dates or time frames because these kids want to start to get behind that wheel and gain that experience.
Dan, in our Iowa City studios, tell us about why you think this new law is good policy, or do you?
Well, we think it's a great idea. The data across the country, not only from Iowa, but around many other states, including the surrounding states like Illinois, Wisconsin, Kansas, have all implemented these new limits in their graduated driver licensing systems. As you mentioned in your intro, Iowa is rated 49th in the country because it really has one of the oldest graduated driver's licensing systems in the whole country. Governor Branstad, under his first administration, was one of the first governors to institute some kind of graduated driver's licensing. But since that was enacted in 1999, it really has not been freshened. So our own Iowa data show that parents support these limits overwhelmingly for the passenger limit as well as the 12-month driver permit phase.
And you've done a lot of research on what leads to these fatal car crashes.
Yes, we have. We've just recently completed a study that looked at all of the teen fatalities in Iowa for a three-year period, and we found that 72% of teen fatalities had other teen passengers on board. So it's very striking to see each one of these fatal crashes and how many times you have other teens on board.
And tell us a little bit about the personal stories, if you can. This is some first-of-its-kind research that you did there. What have you heard? What did you learn in your research, personal stories from parents or teens that you can share with us?
Well, this was very much a unique study nationwide in the sense that we integrated crash reports from law enforcement, from the medical examiner, from media, to create a much brighter picture and developed case studies for each of these fatal crashes. And so about every 8 days in Iowa, we lose a teen to a car crash. So it's a fairly common event. But what was very interesting to us, each one of these tragedies, we were able to paint a picture that is much more detailed than a single newspaper article and so forth. In fact, we found even in one case that there was no media coverage whatsoever for one teen fatality. So it really speaks a lot to the culture of car crashes in our society and how the nickel and diming of people, not only teenagers, but adults as well, is really something that kind of falls to the back burner of how we think about these fatalities. But we had many... every one of these stories is very tragic.
How emotionally difficult is it to study these teen driving accidents?
Having done this for about 20 years now in a variety of different contexts and developing technologies to help avoid crashes in the first place, this was really, I think, the hardest one for our team because it became fairly personal because we looked at not only media reports but social media and so forth to try to really come up with what happened in that crash. And so each of the different players at a scene, so when the police come, they have their job, a fairly specific and narrow job. EMS has a job. People in the emergency department have a job. The medical examiner has a job. The reporter has a job. But all of these people sort of carry sort of a very small sliver of the entire story. And so what we did was sort of put those things together. And I think that was probably, you know, the first time that that's ever happened when you do that. And so we see a very different side of what these tragedies are about.
So does media coverage prompt changed behavior or changes in policy?
Well, not necessarily in Iowa. I think it can. And unfortunately, many times takes a very... big tragedy to at least get things to be spoken about in the legislature. But as we see in a number of different tragedies around the country, not just in car crashes, that it still takes a while and it's incremental. I think that's one thing that I've learned in the policy circles is that you really have to work at these things very slowly and incrementally.
So, Representative Burns, why didn't the law change more quickly or become more restrictive as it did in other states?
Well, I think the comment is definitely correct. I think that government too many times is reactionary instead of proactive, and he's exactly right. I think sometimes it does take maybe a tragedy or tragic stories or a compilation of those stories to really push policy forward, and that's unfortunate. I know that graduated driver's license has been talked about for a time here at the state capitol, and until this year, becoming the transportation chair, you don't maybe have as much of a voice to get some of these things to push forward. So, I do. I wish that when it came to policy that we could be a little bit more proactive. And last week we're on here talking about the fuel tax. And again, I think even that type of a policy, why do we have to be reactive? Why can't we be proactive on the approaches that we take on policy? So, I'm just glad that we did get this move forward this session.
River to River listeners, do you think the legislature is too reactive or proactive? Do the laws on teen drivers impact you personally. What do you think of these tighter restrictions? Does it go far enough? Is it too little? Give us a call, 1-866-780-9100. We're also on Facebook at Iowa Public Radio, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. And Dan, talk a little bit more about the research that you did and how long it took to really feel like you had a sample that you could reach some kind of conclusion with.
Well, we've been doing younger driver research for about 8 years, and we were the first to put little black box video recorders in teen cars about 7 years ago at Clear Creek Amana High School. And this is really our first opportunity to get a window into actual teen driver behavior. And since then, we've had literally hundreds of young driver participants from Iowa, from Minnesota. We have a study going on in Maryland right now, where we're able to get very detailed look into texting and its effects, passengers and its effects, nighttime driving, and just young driving in general, the lack of experience, and what happens inside that car when it leads up to an error and, heaven forbid, a crash.
So what more do you know about the causes of teen driving accidents?
Well, we know that frequently the passengers are a part of that, and as Representative Byrne said, there's a big distraction element with teen passengers. And we've also found that it's not just friends, it's also siblings, and we all know that siblings can be quite crazy inside of a car as well. Certainly texting is an issue. Speed, overwhelmingly, especially on the Iowa rural roadways, is a big issue. But we've also looked at parent attitudes in this, and we conducted a survey with our colleagues at the University of North Carolina to look at Iowa parents of teens, and we surveyed over 1,000 parents of 16-year-olds in Iowa split across rural, middle, and urban areas, and found that they were quite overwhelmingly in favor of these passenger limits. So 79% of Iowa teens, or excuse me, 79% of Iowa parents of teens were in favor of passenger limits.
So do you have advice for parents then, based on all this research that you've conducted and collected?
The best advice is practice, and you want to drive as much as you can as possible with your teens in all conditions. And this is really what the beauty of the 12-month permit period is, as Representative Burns alluded to. This is really that windshield time that he's talking about that is so critical. In fact, I tell parents all the time, when it's a really crappy snowstorm, it's night, it's raining really hard, that's when you want to go out and drive with your teen, because you really don't want them to be driving by themselves in that first snow or that first ice or that first thunderstorm.
So wait till the weather gets bad to learn how to drive.
That's a really important component, that's for sure.
You know, one thing I'd like to add is being a current parent of a 15-year-old, you know, and we talk about technology and how technology can be a distraction, and then the whole texting and things like that. One thing, though, I would like to share with parents that are out there listening today is that you can also use technology as a solution to the technological issue. So, for example, I downloaded an app on my daughter's phone that it's called Canary, and it's an application that it basically connects my phone to her phone. And so while she is driving, I get feedback on my phone based on her speeds, her location. It tells me if her phone is in use, and it definitely tells me if she were to be texting on her phone. So we use technology in our family to kind of keep a proactive approach on my daughter and how she's utilizing that technology. I can also tell you that those people that come to pick up my daughter and maybe have her babysit for them, it also tells me their speed and how fast they're driving. As long as she's in the phone with or in the car with her phone on, I can get that feedback. So I think as we continue down this road, I think that we will use technology to fix some of those technological issues.
So why legislate this? Why not let parents make these decisions?
You know, that was an argument. I mean, that was an argument that I did hear from some legislators is that, you know, we're kind of legislating parenting. And, you know, and I can see that argument, but at the same time, I think that this is something that, you know, anytime we can do something with policy and we can help save some lives, I think that it it trumps that argument.
Yeah, plus parents really like to be able to point to these limits and just, you know, say, hey, you know, you can't have passengers for the first 6 months of your license. It's very easy for parents to do that, and it's many times difficult to get those things across to teens. But the other area, too, that's important about this and the technologies like Canary is that really it promotes more dialogue and conversation about driving. I mean, this, after all, is the most dangerous thing that we let our kids do. And by having that conversation more, then it really becomes a regular feature around the dinner table, too.
Are moving violations an indicator that a teen may be more at risk for a fatal accident, Dan?
Yes, in the Go Team study where we analyzed all of the crashes that we found that many of the fatally injured teens had a moving violation in their background. And so that's something that we're going to be looking at more closely as we start to compare the rest of the population. These are fairly new data, and so we want to be careful before we go a little too far with those. But yes, indeed, many of those teens had moving violations previously.
Representative Burns, what's next in terms of policy?
Oh, I think continuing to work with folks like at the University of Iowa and the research that they've done. I know that there were some other groups, Bell and Blank Children's Center, State Farm actually was very important, AT&T. There's just a lot of different groups that have this research available, and I think as studies continue to happen and that data shows us by doing X, you solve Y, I think that's probably the next steps.
Dan, are other states passing even more restrictions?
Yeah, another area is we look towards the future that we see really good outcomes are related to looking at nighttime limits. Generally, after 10 p.m. is when we start to see a really large increase in crashes and fatal crashes. And this is really when most teens are out on the roads. These are not curfews at all. You can still be out. You just can't be driving for that first 6 months. But, you know, after 10 p.m., Iowa, it's currently, I believe, 12:30 in the morning, whereas other states, North Carolina and others, have really seen dramatic reductions in their fatal crash rates after instituting, actually, it's a 9 p.m. limit in North Carolina.
So who has the strictest policy?
I think that North Carolina is probably one. New Jersey actually has the oldest driving licensing rate in the country, age at 17. And we certainly see that the older you are, the better off you are in terms of fewer crashes and gets to sort of maturity. But that's certainly not a practical thing for most states to change that 16-year-old entry point.
We're getting a few calls now. Mike in Waterloo, what are your thoughts?
Hello?
Hello, Mike. You're on River to River.
I taught driver education in the Waterloo schools for 26 years. I never had a student die in those 26 years, looking back at all the students, never had a student die in an accident. And one of the things that helped us as we did that was we had an 18-week program. And now my granddaughter just took driver ed. She was driving 4 hours at a time. We limited them to an hour a week. And I just think we cut driver ed out of the public schools because of money, and we're sacrificing a lot of things because we're having parents teaching their students rather than a certified teacher.
That's interesting. Representative Burns, did you hear that argument? Yeah. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and the whole scenery of driver's ed programs has really changed. I mean, given my time of getting my driver's ed education, we had I think it was my middle school math teacher or whatever did that for us. He was also the driver's ed teacher. To today, we have more and more companies and more school districts that are subcontracting out or contracting services with independent folks, or you as a parent can just go to an independent group. And that's and I'll be honest with everybody's schedules, and I know that was very difficult for us to find a time frame in which to get our daughter into a program for driver's ed. You know, things, the whole scenery has truly changed in terms of how this is offered.
Dan, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, we certainly do see a very dramatic shift over the last, 10, 15 years as the schools have really gotten out of the driver education business. And we see some contractors who can pack in an entire course practically, I think, in 10 days. I mean, you go to school for like 8 hours a day or something like that, and then you pop out the other end with your signed slip. So I think there's a great deal of variation in terms of curriculum across the state, and that's something that should be looked at as well.
All right. Thanks so much to my guests, Republican Representative Josh Burns from Osage and Dr. Dan McGeehee with the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. Thanks to both of you for being on the show.
Thank you, Clay.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from John Pimble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River are available at our website, iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Clay Masters. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.